I'm Sam Litzinger with Dr. Katie Nelson, host of The Pet Show with Dr. Katie on DC's News Channel 8. Do you have a question for her? Good. 1-877-610-3647. You can visit our Facebook page or our website, wamuanimalhouse.org. Dr. Gary will be back with us next week. Let's take a telephone call from Elliot, who's calling us from Reston, Virginia. Elliot, glad to have you with us in the Animal House. Question for Dr. Katie?
Absolutely. Thanks, Sam. Dr. Katie, I've got a question about ticks and dogs.
Okay.
So here's the question. Our German Shepherd, who's a rescue dog.
And what's his name, by the way?
His name is Rocky.
Rocky the rescue dog. Okay.
Excellent name for a German Shepherd.
He came to us having had a case of Lyme disease, which was apparently cured. The vet has subsequently, we've had several conversations with the vet about Lyme disease and about, I think it's Ehrlichia. Am I saying that right?
Yes, you are.
Good for you.
Which I think it's a separate thing, correct?
It is. It is another tick-borne disease.
So the vet has expressed concern in the past that he does show markers for Ehrlichia. And, of course, with the Lyme disease in the past, we have him on Advantix, and we do pull dead ticks off of him. But obviously, if we go hiking or something, he picks up ticks. So my question is, how worried should I be about this? He doesn't display any of the symptoms that I can find online. And the vet kind of said, well, don't worry about it if he doesn't display symptoms. But I thought I'd ask for some advice.
That's good. And we thought we would bring in an expert on this. This is Dr. David Gaines, who's the Virginia State Public Health Entomologist. Dr. Gaines, thanks very much for being with us in the Animal House. So can you kind of walk us through what's going on here with what Elliot said, and then Katie can jump in as well.
Well, I can tell you that the most common tick to bite people in Virginia would be the Lone Star tick. It is really most common tick in most parts of Virginia, except for some parts of higher elevations in southwestern Virginia where the black-legged tick is more predominant. The primary thing that the Lone Star tick carries is a number of different species of Ehrlichia, which can cause ehrlichiosis. The most important species is Ehrlichia chiffiensis. And that causes most of the severe cases of Ehrlichia, and I understand it can cause disease in dogs. But from what I understand, it's not common in dogs. There must be a certain amount of natural resistance to it because there's an awful lot of Lone Star ticks in Virginia, and a relatively high proportion of them are carrying Ehrlichia pathogens, and relatively few dogs appear to get Ehrlichiosis each year.
Hmm.
At least appear to have symptoms associated with it. And that's all I can say as far as tick-borne diseases in dogs. But Ehrlichiosis is a common disease in Virginia, as the Lone Star tick is the most common tick to bite people. My own estimate would be somewhere 90% of the reported tick bites in Virginia are Lone Star tick bites. The most common cause of tick-borne illness in Virginia is Lyme disease. And that is only transmitted by the black-legged tick. So although Lone Star ticks are far more common than black-legged ticks, Lyme disease is the most common tick-borne disease. And there's some sort of a disconnect in there. And the only way I can explain it is that most people appear to feel Lone Star tick bites. Lone Stars have highly allergenic saliva. And so the bite site begins to itch within the first 12 or 24 hours of attachment, and the people feel that itch, and they go to scratch it, and they feel the tick with their fingertips, and they pull it off before it can transmit. Whereas the black-legged tick it's an insidious little creature, and it contains some anti-inflammatory substances in its saliva that reduce inflammation, reduce itching. So they most often attach to people and stay attached for the duration, 72 hours, 96 hours, until they're full of blood, and then they drop off, and the people bitten by them are none the wiser. They never even know they've been bitten.
Oh, great. All right. Now I'm going to have Dr. Katie just come in on the veterinary aspects of this. Thank you very much, Dr. Gaines. Much appreciated.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Gaines.
All right. Now, Katie, I want you to jump into the veterinary aspects of this and more specifically to Elliot's question.
Okay. Well, so Lyme disease in dogs. about 95% of Lyme-positive dogs never show any sign of Lyme disease. We are not 100% sure exactly how or why they can clear it out of their systems the way that they do. But basically, whenever most of our heartworm tests these days actually test for antigens to Lyme, Ehrlichia, and anaplasmosis. These are all tick-borne diseases. And basically, it just tells us whether they've been exposed. So your dog, it sounds like, actually had a clinical case of Lyme disease at some point. Am I correct in that?
That's my understanding, but again, he's a rescue, so it's a little bit hard to say.
Okay. So we at least know that he has Lyme exposure. And then as far as Ehrlichia, your veterinarian is saying that your dog is coming up positive for that as well. Is that what I'm understanding?
That's correct.
Okay. So what my understanding of this is that basically when they did the heartworm test on your dog showed up positive for antigens against ehrlichiosis and antigens against Lyme disease.
So, that's my understanding as well.
Okay. So going forward, what you need to be watching for in your dog, the ehrlichiosis is not as insidious, I guess, as the Lyme disease is. Lyme disease can lay dormant for many, many, many years. Lyme disease is just kind of a jerk of a disease. I compare it to cancer. What we always say about cancer is cancer does what cancer wants. Well, Lyme disease basically does what Lyme disease wants. If it wants to all of a sudden pop up 8 years down the line and start attacking your dog's joints, it's just going to do that. And if it wants to, oh, by the way, start to attack your dog's kidneys, then, hey, you know what? I'm going to do that too. This is one of these diseases that we just need to really know that it's there. And when, you know, your dog starts to show any sort of an unusual sign, whether it's vomiting and diarrhea, whether it's urinating more or drinking more, whether it's, oh gosh, my leg is hurting, any of those things, no matter where you are, if these things start to happen, when you take your dog into the veterinarian, you need to remind them, by the way, my dog is Lyme positive, and by the way, my dog is Ehrlichia positive, because it can cause so many different types of symptoms. The same thing in people. I mean, so many people go undiagnosed with Lyme disease for so long because it's such a confusing disease process. So, you know, right now, if your dog is not showing any clinical signs of it, I would just keep it on the back burner in your mind. Okay. You can actually get Lyme titers done. You can also get Ehrlichia titers done just so that you see how, you know, how high the antigen level is in your dog. So you sort of have a baseline because, and that may not be a bad idea for you, especially since you're not 100% clear whether your dog had a clinical case of it or if it just, or if he's just Lyme positive his whole life. It may not be a bad idea to get some titers run just so you have a baseline, you know where he is. And that way, if 2 or 3 years from now, he does start to show some sort of clinical signs of it, you have a basis of comparison where you can run that titer again and say, oh, holy moly, he used to be 150 and now he's 1500. You know, this is definitely something that's getting worse, and it's something we need to treat. Lyme disease is treatable. It's never cured. It's always there, but it is definitely treatable.
So just to summarize, I should get some titers done so that I have a level set so that it can be compared against in case this does become an issue in the future.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I mean, I always try to look at this as if this were my dog, and that's definitely what I would do if this were my dog.
Okay, and that's a standard veterinary test, I assume.
It absolutely is. You can just walk into your vet tomorrow and ask for that. They can do it for you.
Thank you, Elliot.
Indeed. Thanks very much. Bye.
Our telephone number is 877-610-3647. Our website is wamuanimalhouse.org. Let's take a telephone call from Ellen, who's calling us from Washington, D.C. Ellen, glad to have you with us in the Animal House. Question for Dr. Katie?
Hi, thank you very much. I'm calling about my 8.5-year-old female cat, who was feral and is a rather fearful kitty. She goes to the vet once a year and for her annual checkup. This year, as every year, the vet recommends that she has her teeth cleaned. And I've been ignoring this for a number of years, and finally this year I said, okay. They did the pre-op blood work, and her ALT, which I believe is a liver enzyme, came back 92, and the normal is between 7 and 60. Her triglycerides were a bit high. Her glucose was a bit high. Lymphocytes were a little low. Monocytes a little high. Now, the vet was mainly concerned about the liver enzymes. She says, well, we can test her again next year. The other lab values, she felt, well, the cat was nervous, and she had eaten a short time before she went to the vet. I'm concerned because I asked the vet about the effects of cleaning, anesthesia, teeth needing to be removed. Could that somehow compromise her health? Could it trigger an illness? And the vet said she couldn't guarantee, she doesn't know. But she felt it was more important to clean her teeth than not to clean it.
All right. So just to translate some of the things that you were saying out there for our listeners out there. Okay. So first thing that people think of when they hear glucose is elevated is, oh, my gosh, does this cat have diabetes? But if it's a mild elevation, and then you went on to describe the lymphocytes and the monocytes having some aberrations as well. What we see in kitties especially is that when they are stressed, their glucose can go up mildly. So let's say the normal for the glucose on this particular blood panel was 170. If we see, a 190 or a 210 or something along those lines, and we've got a cat that was definitely very nervous, and then we also see this lymphocyte and this monocyte aberration, then we basically say, okay, we had a stressed out kitty here. If we were to take this same blood sample while this cat's chilling out on the couch at home, it's probably going to be very different because this is just how sort of the body metabolizes stress. The triglycerides definitely can be affected if they've eaten within the last couple of hours before the blood sample was taken. So that, again, is not very nerve-wracking. The ALT being 92 definitely is something that is, as you said, an abnormality. It is definitely high. It's not the highest that I've ever seen. Was there a thyroid level on that blood panel as well? Do you remember, Ellen?
I don't think so.
Okay. That would be number one that I would check is if the thyroid was not tested on that blood panel, I would make sure that we've tested the thyroid as well. Because with hyperthyroidism, which is the most common thyroid issue that we see in cats, an elevated thyroid, we can see elevation of the ALT, of that liver enzyme. So that would be the first little additional test that I would do, is to make sure that our thyroid is within the normal range. As far as your question goes about the teeth cleaning, I do tend to agree with your veterinarian that if you've got a cat that is otherwise healthy and we've got one blood abnormality, we have to remember that we test for about four or five different liver enzymes. The alkaline phosphatase, the ALP, the ALT, the all of these other enzymes that we test for, bilirubin, all these other things, they also tell us about the liver function. So the fact that we've got one of the liver enzymes showing some abnormalities, that to me is more of a, okay, I'm going to keep my eye on that. I'm going to try and figure out why that's happening. But it's not something that's going to preclude me from recommending a dental cleaning if your cat has bad teeth. Because what we know about dental disease is that dental disease can cause disease throughout the entire body. It can cause liver disease. It can cause kidney disease. It can go pretty much anywhere throughout the body. The other thing is you have a female kitty. Kitties are very good groomers for the most part. And when they sit there with all of that nasty bacteria in their mouth and they groom themselves, they can also set themselves up for urinary tract infections. Because the most common way that female cats, or female animals especially, get urinary tract infections is ascending bacteria from the outside of the body. It crawls up in through the wider urethra of the female into the bladder and can set up shop in the bladder. So is it worth having done? You bet it is. And especially the big part about dental cleanings are that we're able to do x-rays and assess the roots as well of the outside of the teeth. Because if we've got a rotten root, and then that tooth does need to come out as your veterinarian recommended, because that can start to cause an abscess up there, right up close to the eye, right up close to the brain. You get these abscesses and all of this bacteria is just sitting right there next to all of these vital organs. And you definitely need to take those out of there before they cause problems.
Sounds like there's probably a tooth cleaning in your future, Ellen. Thank you very much, and let us know
how
it goes, okay?
I'm very impressed. Thank you very much.
I am too. I'm constantly impressed. Between Dr. Katie and Dr. Gary, I'm in danger of actually learning something at some point.
We are just a wealth of knowledge, aren't we?
Thank you, Dr. Katie.
Absolutely.
This is Dr. Gary Weitzman with an Animal House Pet Tip. This one's for Emily, who asks about the plight of shelter animals, and her question specifically asks about rural Virginia and the eastern shore of Maryland. Emily's right in that she says every shelter isn't like the San Diego Humane Society or the Washington Animal Rescue League, two places I know very well, in which animals get complete rehab treatment and aren't euthanized for space or time. But not every municipal shelter has those resources, and some, they might seem to be caught in the 1950s in terms of standards of care. But that's changing. And with that, I hope, are partnerships between shelter haves and shelter have-nots, so every animal gets a chance. I think Emily's right. Everyone should visit their local shelter, whether they're a private, nonprofit, or a government facility. Know what you're supporting, and for heaven's sake, support it. Animal homelessness is all of our responsibility, and that responsibility starts with knowing the shelter in your own backyard. For the Animal House, this is Dr. Gary Weitzman.
This edition of the Animal House is almost complete, but first here's the answer to our Animal of the Week quiz. Earlier we asked if you knew the name of the aquatic dad that bears the offspring. The answer is the seahorse. Males carry the eggs during incubation, and once the young are released, their job is finished. The seahorse lives in tropical and temperate waters around the globe. Special thanks to Dr. Katie Nelson, and thanks to you for joining us in the Animal House.